Dr. Alan Brackley was born and educated in the state of Maine. Various members of his family were involved in logging, production of forest products, and investment in small timberland tracts. His education includes degrees in forest utilization, forest products, business, and economics. Most of his professional career has been spent working for private sector firms as a land manager and a resource analyst. In the private sector, he was often involved in due diligence aspects of projects to select sites for new forest products, production firms, evaluate opportunities for purchasing wood, evaluation of markets for products, and investments in forest land. He moved to Alaska in 2001 and initially was employed as the director of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Forest Products Program in Sitka. In 2004, he accepted employment with the United States Forest Service as team leader of the Alaska Wood Research and Development Center in Sitka. Dr. Alan Brackley.
I'm not used to being called Dr. Brackley. I'm Alan. And a lot of times when I give talks to groups, there's a tendency to beat our chest and tell everybody what we've done. And over the last 10 years, we've published at the center over 100 publications on various topics, and I've got some of the more current ones up here. And all I can say is if you're in research, usually one of the measures that people judge you by is how much you publish. And it's kind of a brutal word. If anybody's interested, I've got a list that goes through May 2009 of the publications that have come out of Sitka. Quite frankly, there's not much in there that's bedtime reading. It's if you're interested in the specifics of one of the topics, and they might be readable. If you're not interested in them, they're terrible. But that's the way research is. We tend to focus on problems that the industry has or that someone identifies, and we're not Ken Follett's. Anyway, I thought today I'd be more interested to talk a little bit about what we've learned about Sitka, because living in Sitka is a pretty fascinating situation. And we're in Sitka, but our mandate is to conduct research that's of value to the state of Alaska. And early in the history of the center, we focused on Southeast Alaska. But anyway, a lot of our ideas gel from things that happen here in Sitka. And quite frankly, I'm more of an applied scientist than a scientist. I love to work with things that might mean something to people in the communities we live in and to the industries in Alaska. And we've learned a little about the land, a little about future supplies of wood, a little about conditions that impact wood in use, and a little about people and their opinions. The Sitka Ranger District is one of the districts on the forest, and it also happens to be one of the largest. If you look at it, we're looking at about 1.9 million acres of forest land, and if you want to look at the non-productive land, of that million acres, almost 975,000 of those acres are waste. Well, if you're interested in tourism and certain types of recreation, sometimes the waste is more important than the land. But if you look at this data, and this is fairly recent, it comes out of a database that's generally available to a lot of people in the Forest Service, there's 25,000 acres of ice in Sitka. You basically have a lot of rock. You've got some alpine, but if you're interested in certain parts of recreation, sometimes that type of land is more valuable than the forest land. One of the things that a lot of people talk about is second growth and young growth. And there's kind of a general opinion that whatever future wood supply is going to come out of the Tongass in this area, it's going to be from second growth stands. If you add it all up, there's about 61,000 acres of stands that are classified as young growth. And this is the distribution of the ages of those stands. We're increasingly spending a lot more time, and some of my research right now is focusing on just exactly what's there. If you're familiar with the pulp mill, you can look at the cut and you can tell a lot. We also have some special problems in Sitka with our climate about the impact on wood products. One of the wood products we talk a lot about nowadays is firewood or biomass or something that you can use for energy. And the reality of the situation is wood is hydroscopic. As the moisture content of the air changes, wood dries and it absorbs moisture back and forth. If any of you are real interested in this, I've got a piece of firewood that's been in my office for a year and it's 8%. And I stopped by the wood pile coming over here and took a piece of firewood that's been exposed to the weather for about a year. And the reality of the situation is, year in, year out, if you can get wood to 17.5% dry moisture content, or well, there's one here somewhere. Okay, there's your green moisture content. Wood technologists talk about moisture content in relation to the dry fiber in the wood. Engineers, when they burn wood, talk about moisture content in relation to the total weight of the wood. So if you look at it at low moisture contents, the 17.9% dry basis that you saw on the first chart translate to 14.9% on a green basis. And anybody that's working with fuel, they're concerned with the moisture content in the wood. The reality of Sitka, you can't get wood that's exposed to the environment, even if it's covered, below 15% moisture content. That's not too bad, but in a lot of parts of the world, they can get it down to, say, 9 or 10%, maybe 11%. But in Sitka, your wood's always going to be greener. I bought my moisture meter, and if you're interested, we can play games later on. One of the realities of Alaska, we live in a state that's very, very rich in resources, and everybody talks about prices and how high it is. Yet, in Anchorage, Alaska, they have some of the lowest natural gas rates in the world and in the United States. The only state that has natural gas that's any cheaper than the state of Alaska is Utah. And the reason for that is very, very simple. In both Utah and Alaska, the gas is drilled and comes from sources within the state, and as a public utilities commission that regulates the price of the thing. And in a regulatory environment, I don't know, I'm used to Canada, and you looked at any publicly utility company, and the rate they're allowed was 14%. I don't know exactly what the rate is in Alaska, but it's 17%. You and I would be well satisfied with that rate. But the oil companies, because of the fact that prices are on world markets and a lot of other things, 17% is a modest return on investment. And we read in the paper that there's no more natural gas in Alaska, and major companies are going to sell all the holdings and move out. I don't know. But anyway, we're not always the highest price when it comes to energy. If you live in Anchorage, you're in great shape as far as natural gas. If you live anywhere else other than the valley, that's a whole different story. We live by a different price structure. And if you look at the price of natural gas up in Fairbanks, it's almost equivalent to the return in BTU value that we get in oil. I took an NSTAR thing here to kind of confirm the whole thing. This whole energy business basically spurned some research projects 2 or 3 years ago, and some people down in Portland that I report to said, Alan, we'd like you to look at some of the aspects of biomass energy. And at that time, everybody's talking about supply. And there's a lot of parts of the country that supply is very, very easy. If you live in Alaska, especially southeast Alaska, it grows all over the place, but it's a real challenge sometimes to get it to the point where someone can use it. So I said, I don't mind doing this, but I'd rather look at the demand. I'd rather turn the thing around and see, okay, how much wood would it take if we wanted to start converting high-priced fuel oil? And these are two publications, and one of them, the one on the left, is one that focuses on published data from the Energy Information Agency and the Bureau of Census. And I was able to basically take the reported volumes of fuel of various types from 2006 and match them up with some census data so I could prorate them to various communities in Alaska based upon housing. And nobody, to my knowledge, has done this, but I tied it to census tracts so that if you're a small community in the southeast, you've got an initial estimate of just exactly how far you could go. Well, that estimate's great, but there's a lot of things other than just coming up with the number. And basically, the second study we did is we started doing some sampling of consumer interest, attitudes, response, so that we could take the number in the first publication and adjust it so that we could say, all right, if oil prices get to a certain point and people just can't afford to pay, and wood is an alternative, assuming somehow or other we can get the stuff off the stump into the consumer, how much would it take? And so it's been kind of an interesting study. I basically took a fuel cost calculator, and I've set this particular analysis. This comes off a website by the American Pellet Fuel Institute, and it's available to anybody that wants to play with it. But essentially, I put the Coast Guard scenario on there, and I turned it around so that you could look at the cost per million BTU that they use in the recently completed Japonski Island Energy Study. And essentially, at fuel oil, they were paying $30.39 per million BTUs. Going to wood pellets, they're going to pay somewhere around $20.96 for the material at the price. And this takes efficiency, this takes moisture content, this takes a whole bunch of things. And I'm not going to say it's perfect. Engineers always have a great time. But it's getting close to the situation. And essentially, if you look at Anchorage in here with their natural gas, for a million BTUs, someone in Anchorage would pay about $11.09. The rest of us in Alaska, if we're on fuel oil, electricity really isn't that great a buy. If you look at the cost of a million BTUs at $3.25 with 78% efficiency, it's $30.19. If you take and go to electricity at 11.7 cents per kilowatt hour, you're talking about $34.47 per million BTUs. It's extremely environmentally friendly if you generate it with hydropower, but it's expensive. So anyway, I did that one on the Coast Guard. The pellet stove and the wood-burning stove that were on the publication cover of one of the studies, actually, I have them at my house. I've been burning wood pellets for 3 years. I decided if I was going to be in this business, I'd learn something about it. And so I have a combination in my house. I have a wood stove, I have a pellet stove, and I have a Toyo oil stove. I have 1,500 square feet that I heat. And if anybody ever told me that I'd come to Alaska and be heating with a Toyo space heater, I'd have said they're crazy, but that's the way the Southeast is. It's a pretty mild climate when you compare it with strong Maine, St. John, New Brunswick, or Prince George, British Columbia, or the other places that I've lived. And I've got a complete history on this stuff, so that if you want to, I can tell you one thing. If you figure out the BTUs required to heat a house, and you start looking at the efficiency of your burning equipment, and you go across, it takes the same number of BTUs. I calculated before I started, I was going to use 5.8 tons of pellets the first year I had my pellet stove. And I used 5.9 tons. So that you get working with this as an engineer, and hey, it comes out. The cost of pellets that I personally pay, a million BTUs is costing me $25.76. And if I use fuel oil at $3.25, it would be $30.19. There's a modest reduction in cost, about 14%. The payback on a pellet stove, if you have to pay the retail prices here in Sitka, it's going to take you 7 or 8 years to replace it. Economic benefits? It's friendly. You're replacing below-ground carbon from oil with above-ground carbon. Pellet stoves are very clean. They meet the EPA emission standards. I went over to the senior center and got my flu shot this morning, and I'm old enough that I'm on Medicare, and my wife and I, we're still handling 40-pound bags of pellets, but I'm going to tell you, there's a lot of things about pellet stoves that a lot of people just don't want. We're used to the convenience of fill up the tank and push the button. Well, you're not going to have that with pellets. But if the oil price gets to a certain point, I don't think the price of pellets is going to increase proportional with the cost of oil. And so it's an alternative worth thinking about maybe in the future. Right now today, in good faith, looking here, I couldn't say, yeah, if you want to play some games and you're interested, go buy a pellet stove. If you want heat for your house, use something else. One of the things in the publication is we figured out a whole bunch of relationships for the cost of a million BTUs. And anybody that's interested, the tables are there. The second study, we focused on consumer attitudes. We went to Fairbanks, Anchorage, Ketchikan, Juneau, and we actually asked some people in Sitka here. And we asked it in relation to wood heat, because if you look at those previous price analyses, if you're paying, say, $300 a cord for cut and split firewood, and you can get it dried down to 17%, and you look at the cost per million BTUs, it's a couple $3 per million BTUs. But you have to handle it, you have to split it. You know, my wife is a person that spent all her life, she loves wood heat, and we'll buy wood in various forms. I get my grandson to split it. My wife does all the piling, and I benefit from it. The cost per million BTUs is extremely low. My wood stove, boy, I got to be careful here. It was built in 1976. It's typical of a lot of the people. It's a great big box stove that has a blower on it and a heat exchanger, and I can raise the temperature in the 1,500 square feet house that I live in to 80 degrees without too much effort. And once you get it going, it's not bad, but it doesn't meet EPA standards. I've had some experience looking at some of the new EPA-approved stoves with catalytic burners. They're very clean. They're very efficient. If you don't mind handling a little bit of wood, you can heat your house cheap. They also require a degree of maintenance. And one of the things I'm looking at is just exactly how much maintenance does it keep or does it take if you're going to use one of those year in, year out. But I can tell you that I know of people that they will put a fire in those things, say at 8 o'clock in the evening. It will maintain the heat in the house until 6 o'clock the next morning without another stick of wood. They're very efficient. They use less wood. They're clean. It's an alternative. And they're cheap, especially if you have a source of wood you can generate on yourself. But anyway, when we asked people what they thought about wood heat, there was quite a number of the people. They said, well, it's smoky. And if you look at this, the smoky people, most of them came from South Central, the people in the interior, but the smoke didn't seem to bother people in the Southeast. There were some people that said it was expensive, and all I can say is, boy, we've got some people out there that need some education. Not widely available, and that is the case, that if you're in Sitka, there is some problems getting firewood. Some people said too much work, and here again, the people that thought it was too much work, 45% of the respondents up in Anchorage thought that, and I guess that's what happens when you move to Anchorage. Slightly less than 30% in the Southeast said it was too much work, and people up in Fairbanks, about 25%. And there was a plethora of other reasons. I don't have any storage space. I can't get a stove into my house. And all of these things, yep, that's the reality of a lot of homes today. You couldn't put a wood stove in them if you tried. This is a table that came out of the report on demand. And I thought you might like to look at the thing. And if you don't consider everything, you just convert the values. And you took everybody that was burning fuel oil in Sitka, and you replaced them, it would take 13,800 cords of wood or 1,400-800 pounds of pellets. If you converted everybody in the residential and commercial sector, it would almost double those numbers. Hey, if it was available, people had to, one way or another. If you replace the fuel oil in Sitka with wood or pellets, that's what it would take. But the second study tells us, we did some analysis and we found that about a third of the people, and they tended to be older people, said, we're not going to switch to any form of renewable biomass. They have oil, they have electricity up in Anchorage, they have natural gas. We're not going to switch, no matter what. And then the second thing that came up was many, many homes today, and especially if you get in build-up areas, you just can't put in a wood stove. You have no space to store the wood, no area to work it up. And so that's going to cut an awful lot of people out. When we got done kind of adjusting what was there with the opinions that we got, in Sitka, if the price of oil started to get in the range of $4 or $5 a gallon, and whether it will or won't, I don't know. That's almost a topic for another day. It might take 6,900 cords or 7,400 tons of pellets. And if you went to the commercial sector, 11,250, 14,500. Now, the interesting thing about this is that if you're in the business of harvesting wood, those volumes of wood are so small that you wouldn't have any economy of scale. It hardly justifies going out and buying the equipment that it takes to cut wood in a lot of areas of the country. But in Alaska, if you look at the whole cost of cutting wood, there isn't enough volume there to begin building up anything where you'd have any economy of scale, any ability to make a profit from it unless the price of oil goes to, say, $5 a barrel or something of that sort. I took the cost of a BTU of oil at $5 and turned it around and said, okay, if I bought my BTUs in the wood, how much would it cost me? And believe you me, it's a real, real eye-opener. You get at the point of $4 where you can pay more than any historic price that I can ever generate from data that I have. If the price of oil goes wild, you might be surprised what happens. There'd be a real economic incentive, and just for that amount of wood, I think the way it's going to happen, I think one or two locations in Southeast Alaska are going to create the ability to do it, and they're going to barge it to everybody else. And in a sense, we've got a guy down in Ketchikan that's already doing this. These are some of the things we concluded. When you look at the economics, if anything's going to be replaced, it's going to be the fuel oil. So the whole thing, when you look at the future, what's the price of fuel oil going to be? Electricity is something that comes along. The real issue is how much are we going to pay for electricity in the years ahead? We're already at the point where electricity, while it's environmentally friendly, as far as the BTU values it produces, it's cheaper to use oil almost right now. And as the price of oil goes up, the whole question becomes, what's the price of electricity going to be? If you look at Alaska, there's hardly any place in Alaska that the biomass doesn't exist. It's fallen down around our ears. The whole issue is, in Alaska, we have a lack of harvesting capacity. One of the studies we're doing right now is we're doing a survey to find out how much harvesting equipment and how many people in various areas of Alaska have the ability to cut wood. And we're doing it because people keep talking about these projects, and I keep telling them, it's one thing if you live in a state that has an active forest products industry, and people are already cutting wood. The incremental ability of those people to cut additional wood will drive a lot of projects. And if you look at the East, you look at the Pacific Northwest, there's all kinds of people that 5 years ago they cut logs and pulpwood. Now they cut logs, pulpwood, and they pick up all kinds of material that they used to leave on the ground or didn't use, and they use it for biomass. Another source of biomass is if you have a big forest products industry. You go down to Prince George, British Columbia, and within 10 miles of the center of city, you have 5 sawmills that are producing over 200 million board feet a year. That's one mill is producing twice the volume of lumber that is required in Alaska for the entire state. Well, if you've got an industry like that, you've also got the residuals from the sawing process. And if you look at a sawmill, half of the volume that goes into the sawmill comes the other out as lumber. The remaining amount of it, sawdust, chips, bark, it's all biomass that you can burn. Any sawmill in Alaska that's producing lumber has the ability to turn around and say, I'm going to take these waste products and I'm going to sell them for energy products. And it's interesting if you go around the state. We got a mill up in Delta Junction that's a small mill. And those people went out and they bought the equipment to make pellets, and they can produce somewhere around 2,000 tons of pellets a year. It's a small, and by a lot of people's standards, it's an inefficient, uneconomic operation. But they're doing it, and because of the transportation to bring pellets from other places, they basically have people saying, look, I'd like to get on your list, and I'd like to use pellets. They're limited by the amount of wood that they use, and by the equipment that they purchase. But it's a little bit like the Field of Dreams in some area of Alaska. If you create something for a low-cost energy source relative to the other things, they will buy and they will come. If you look at Southeast Alaska, one of the difficult things about this, we don't have any forest industry left. We have a couple of mills, one of which hasn't operated down in Ketchikan for the last year, and a bunch of small mills. If you look at the residual from those mills and start looking at the figures that we've got, there just isn't the material to meet the needs of the entire area of Southeast Alaska. In fact, I did some figures and I put them out, and they've appeared in half a dozen different reports, and some of the people gave me credit for them, some of them didn't. But you could meet maybe 20% of the potential demand with the residuals from the existing mill if they all operated and they were all interested in doing it. Never forget that the pulp and paper industry down on the Fraser River and on Victoria Island and in Washington, Oregon, buys the chips from those mills. And so if you're going to buy those chips away, you're going to compete with the pulp and paper industry and a pulp and paper industry price. So we have a lot of information. I got some stuff here, and you know, we spend an awful lot of time where people call us on the phone. And we talked a lot with the Coast Guard about Chaponsky Island. They asked us opinions, and then they went out and hired some consultants. And a lot of the information we provided free to the Coast Guard, the consultants confirmed. There's a big study, several of the McDowell studies over in Juneau. The first place that they come when they're hunting for information is to people like us that are familiar with Southeast Alaska. And it's a little bit sour grapes. There's a lot of the people that if you read it, they'll say, and we thank so-and-so for information, and the Beck Group was very, very kind in the direction to the second young growth harvesting costs and mentioned where they got it. Different people have a different approach to that, so that many times we're involved in a lot of activities where people want information about Southeast Alaska. They come to us, and it's kind of funny. Sometimes I do oddball little things to see and to track things, and once in a while I purposely put an error in, and when you look at half a dozen reports and that same error proves in something that someone has been hired as a consultant to do it, you get a feeling, well, it'll be interesting to see how that one goes. But anyway, we answer questions, we're available. If people are interested in our opinions of something that are personal. And in another time and place, I'll talk about opinions. There's a lot of factual information in this world that people want to know. If I put a mill in here and I sell this product and the mill does this and that, what's the impact on the amount of wood or what I have to cut to get it in there? I spent my life working with those type of problems, and I sometimes have to chuckle because I know of one report that went to a native corporation here in Alaska that the consultant that did the report, she said, "Alan, can you write down how you arrived at that?" And I thought for a few minutes, and I thought, yeah, I'll tell you how. I'm at the point where I'm not going to. I am what I am, and I'm where I am, and I love it. But, you know, if I can help somebody, I will. But I was kind of fascinated by it. It was one of the major consulting firms in the Pacific Northwest. They'd been hired by a major native corporation in Alaska, and they didn't know how, to work through the process of the stump to the consumer. And so I showed them how we did it. And in that instance, I was never, there was never anything to say that they talked with someone at the Sitka Wood Utilization Center in Sitka, Alaska. But yet, there's a lot of people out there that are making decisions and spending money. We have a lot of input into some of those things. And sometimes we get credit when we publish. We get credit. But there's a lot of times that we do a lot of things that one way or another, they just sit in the background. And it's okay with me. Anyway, if you're interested, you want a little bit of help and some ideas, that's my telephone number, my email address. And I'd always help anybody in Sitka in any way I can. Thank you.